This is Carl Weinschenk for the Daily Music Break. The Daily Music Break is at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Please stop by for great music across all eras and genres, email newsletters, and updates on what's going on in the world of music. Today, we're thrilled to be speaking with Marty Newland. Dr. Newland is a core lecturer in humanities at Columbia. She's a performer and also a researcher, so we're really, really interested in speaking to her. Hi, Marty. How are you today?
Hi, I'm great and happy to be speaking with you.
Well, thanks very much for taking time out. We really appreciate it very, very, very much.
My pleasure.
I first found out about you by watching a video where you performed very beautifully some work by Eva Jessy. Could you tell us a little bit about Eva Jessy?
Yes. I was actually introduced to her through the keyboardist, artist Wodehouse. I wasn't familiar with her significance before preparing for that performance, actually, that's on YouTube from a few years ago. But Eva Jessy was an African-American female composer, also a choral director, a poet, and an actress, and had a very interesting childhood that I think impacted her artistic life, in that she grew up in rural Kansas and also Seattle, and she grew up in a part of Kansas called Coffeyville that was deemed as a free part of Kansas, and then went on to study composition at university, Langston University in particular, a historically black college. And then she studied composition privately with Will Marion Cook while she was living in New York City. Will Marion Cook is another very significant African-American composer. Duke Ellington studied with him. Well, actually several composers, but Eva Jessy and Ellington come to mind at the moment. Mm-hmm. She also founded the Eva Jessy Choir. This was in the 1920s, and then began working closely with Virgil Thomson and George Gershwin. And it was in her work with them that I think she really launched into an international career in African-American music, mm-hmm. in that she was the choral master for Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, the debut performance in 1935, and then stayed with productions of Porgy and Bess throughout the rest of her life. She died in 1992. And then she was also in the chorus for Thomson's Four Saints and Three Acts. And as someone, though she's not as widely known as she should be, who really shaped what we know of as African-American opera choral sound, and through her work with Porgy and Bess in particular, then I think shaped other singers' careers in very direct ways. And then outside of her work as an opera choral director, or opera, chorus master, mm-hmm. she also was appointed by Martin Luther King Jr. To be the official choir of the 1963 March on Washington. And so it was her Eva Jessy Choir that was the choir for that very historic event.
Wow.
And then she went on to hold academic positions at Morgan State University and also the University of Michigan. It was her book of her collection of concert spirituals that she called My Spirituals, which I think is a very interesting title, that she published in 1927. And she said, I actually remember a quote that she said about her arrangement of those spirituals. And she said, these are her words, "I was not obliged to delve into remote corners of the South or coax them from reluctant elders. They are the songs of my childhood." And I think that her relationship to spirituals and even what she wanted to do in that anthology was something, that assertion I think is significant in relation to her work with Gershwin. She wasn't someone who was an ethnologist necessarily in ways that a lot of, well, Gershwin we can say, and Virgil Thompson, their relationship to African American music was perhaps a bit voyeuristic and not necessarily as grounded as what Eva Jessye wanted to express.
Right.
In her collection, which she did there. And it's, I mean, one could hear in the recordings, her harmonizations, the sparseness of the accompaniment, some of the rhythmic choices she has in the vocal line are all even distinct from some other popular spirituals that are heard in music theater, or how Gershwin draws upon spirituals in vocal parts in Porgy and Bess. She asserts something different, quite unique, and I think specific to that region of the country of rural Kansas. But that's a little bit about Jessye.
It's fascinating. Through a previous interview I did, I'm aware of the importance of Porgy and Bess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure you're right about it being voyeuristic. The meeting of this woman who had the real experiences with the, you know, this guy from, you know, from Tin Pan Alley, you know, whose parents were Russian Jews and everything. It's just it's almost a very American thing where you have someone with the real experience working with someone who's kind of synthesizing it more for the masses. It sounds like a very, you know, even another level of the importance of Porgy and Bess in our culture.
I think that's true. Porgy and Bess, I think, is actually a very complicated artistic expression that does get to the heart of very complicated American issues around social position, race, class, ethnicity, and region that are worthy of actually considering a little bit more. And I want to say, I don't want to suggest at all that Gershwin's experiences and what he was expressing in that work weren't real.
Right.
They're just different from Eva Jessye, who is someone who is a descendant of formerly enslaved Africans in the U.S. Right. And also a descendant of free Africans in the U.S. in the 19th century, which is special.
Yeah.
Very special. And I think that, like in other parts of African American music, it's those experiences, especially from her childhood, that really inform her artistry in ways that are different from Gershwin, who too had a love for the music of African Americans, and I think as best as he could, perhaps a respect for the experience of African Americans in the United States, but they were on two different paths, right. And I think had a great synergy artistically.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost what I'm thinking is, it's almost the beauty. One of the beauties of America is the ability to synthesize all these things, you know, and
yes.
That's like a synthesis of what Gershwin was and where he came from with the, you know, with someone who had authentic experiences around Porgy and Bess. You know, her experiences, I'm sure, were different. But it's just a really interesting topic.
Yes, it is.
You know,
I do have to note, even with these syntheses, I mean, and Eva Jessye's relationship to George Gershwin is just one example. This happens over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
The artistic synthesis doesn't always do the work of really overcoming a perpetuation of racist anti-Black oppression.
Right.
That doesn't play out necessarily in the music making, but perhaps in the way that contracts are written or how credits are assigned.
Right.
That, though I don't know the details of it, I remain very suspicious of how that could have played out for Eva Jessye in her career.
One of the things I read on the Wikipedia profile of her as I was preparing for this is that she demanded that the people in the choir got paid for rehearsals as well as the performances, because apparently people were getting ripped off, and you know, we know how that movie looks.
Yes.
And she was she demanded that people, you know, kind of be taken care of properly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that almost speaks to that. So it sounds like she's a very strong person is what it sounds like.
Oh, yes. Very, very clear about what the right thing is to do, that for sure.
what attracted you to her musically that you endeavored to actually perform some of her work?
Well, it was that initial introduction from artist Wodehouse, who's the accompanist for the recordings online.
Mm-hmm.
And she presented the pieces to me and asked if I would be interested in performing them. And what in particular was very enticing was Eva Jessye's Midwestern heritage. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and have sung spirituals for a large part of my life, the concert spiritual tradition. And I had yet actually to come across an anthology of spirituals written from someone who grew up in the Midwest. A lot of the spirituals are from composers throughout the Northeast
mm-hmm.
that I had come across to that point, I want to be clear,
mm-hmm.
And the Southeast,
right.
and a few from the West Coast. But I was drawn to what could be distinct about what she's drawing from when she says my spirituals and the spirituals of her childhood. That could be something I personally could relate to, and I certainly did. And I also then, once I started preparing the music, really, really loved how she set spirituals that are very popular mm-hmm. and arranged by lots of other composers. But in particular, the rhythmic approach and vocal line and her harmonization in the piano part.
Fascinating. Very mm-hmm. interesting. What popped into my head, and you know, I might be going off on a silly tangent here, but what wasn't Scott Joplin from the Midwest too?
Yeah, this Midwest line is tricky, right? So he is. That's Texarkana region. Excuse me. Certainly is the Midwest. I mean, I say that from a very from a different perspective than perhaps thinking about, excuse me, Cincinnati, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, this is true. Even H.T. Burley from Erie, Pennsylvania, he's right on the line of Northern Ohio.
Right.
There certainly are other composers, but Kansas, I mean, right in the middle.
Right in the middle of Kansas.
Right in the middle. And not Joplin certainly had interaction with and influence with Texas, New Orleans, in ways that I think in Kansas is a little bit different, the flow of activity.
So he's different. So what I hear you saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the Midwest isn't a monolithic place. I mean, I'm a New Yorker, so I probably think that way. But there's different. The Midwest is pretty big place.
It is a very big place, and that's exactly what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Not to take away from any of the other composers from the Midwest at all, and there are many of them. But
right.
Concert spirituals from Kansas, I had yet to come across.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, I mean, Charlie Parker came out of Kansas, right?
Exactly.
In Kansas City, and Big Joe Turner, and you know, the list is essentially endless.
Exactly.
Now, for the next few minutes, I'd really like to talk about your background. By the way, this is as good a time as any. I told you at the beginning I was going to ask where folks can read about you online, and I promptly forgot.
Oh, sure.
Where folks are interested in finding out a little bit more about your research and my clumsy questions are going to get to, where can they go on the internet?
Sure. There are actually two great places. The first is my personal website, which is martynewland.com. And the second place is the Columbia University Music Department website, mm-hmm. which is music.columbia.edu.
Okay, great. Tell me a little bit, please, about your research. What you look at? The guy. I tried to read it, and it got over my head amazingly quickly. So if you could tell us, that would be great. Sometimes I do better when I'm actually hearing it from the person.
Sure. I'm an ethnomusicologist, and I specialize in African-American music, mm-hmm. voice studies, the anthropology of education, and performance studies. Those are my four areas of research. They're all connected in really a desire to have a set of answers to the question, how do we assign blackness to our listening and musical experiences, music performance experiences? How do we hear someone singing as black or they're speaking as black? And how does a musical composition get categorized as black or heard as black? That's my main research question. My latest project was the completion of my PhD dissertation, which is titled Sounding Black, a Racialized Ethnography of Fisk University, Ethnography of Racialized Vocality at Fisk University. Mm-hmm. And that was a long-term study of black students at a historically black college, where singing is taken very seriously and very much a priority in everyday life. Fisk University is the home to the renowned and critically acclaimed Fisk Jubilee Singers, mm-hmm. the first choral ensemble and set of singers to introduce the world to the concert spiritual tradition. And it's a place where that tradition remains alive, and the students remain very committed to maintaining the tradition. And also, they're also very aware of the power of vocality to bring about change. So it was a great place to ask these questions. Mm-hmm. And I argue that the racialization process in the United States is not something that's just bound to phenotype, but is also bound to the sonic realm as well, and especially in people's voices.
What's phenotype mean?
How someone looks and the color of their skin.
Okay, so you are saying that classification of folks goes beyond what they look like to what they sound like, and then the norms are in someone's supposed to sound a certain way?
For better or worse, exactly. Uh-huh. So, for example, people listening to this podcast, I'm arguing, draw conclusions about race from the sound of our voices, both of us, okay. without ever seeing either one of us, without having a picture. The way that we speak, the sound of our voice, is also a part of the substance of how race and racism work in the U.S.
Would it extend beyond race? For instance, if I'm Jewish, if I came on, I had a heavy Yiddish accent or something, mm-hmm. would it be kind of the same? Or if my father, I wish you could get on, he's no longer here, but he was German.
Yes.
And he had a pretty heavy German accent, though it might be interesting to you, I could not hear his accent.
Huh, that's fascinating.
It was really fascinating because people would make fun of his accent, you know, kiddingly. Everyone loved my dad. But I could not hear his accent. He didn't have an accent to me. It was very, very strange. My whole life, I didn't hear him as having an accent.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this extends to all kinds of social categories and positions, and also extends to the transformation of them. So I don't think but I just focus on the racialization process in my own work. Mm-hmm. So this can extend across the board and is also something that can be changed, right? This is what actors, singers do.
Right.
And I think people make those changes in their everyday life for different political and social reasons all the time. But that's at the heart of what I work to uncover.
Mm-hmm. Is what you study, has it changed do you think? I mean, you weren't doing this 30, 40 years ago, obviously. But has it changed because of the media and because of the internet and because of the fact that their distance doesn't mean as much as it did 50 years ago, 60 years ago? There is constant, you know, instantaneously wherever you want to be, in a sense, through telecommunications. Does that change things for what you study?
I do think that the digital era has enormous implications for this work that's different from moments past.
Mm-hmm.
In that the way to identify people is not necessarily in physically co-present moments.
Right.
So the big answer is to that is yes. But I also have to say that these research questions are by no means new and have been, I mean, I'm really drawing upon a long legacy of the work of American anthropologists,
mm-hmm.
Going back to Boas, really, and Zora Neale Hurston. Especially starting in the late 19th through the early 20th century, there's a long line of scholars asking these questions, really specific to their time.
Mm-hmm.
As I am, but this era right now, I think will change the course of human social life for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it might not be for the better, but that remains to be seen.
Yes, we will see.
were you a performer first and then a researcher, or a researcher, then a performer, or are they did they come around at the same time? And which do you consider to be your day job, so to speak?
Yes, you know, that's a very interesting question, and not I can't say that the answer is very direct for me, in that my singing experiences are a research methodology for me in my work, and so that research process has been going on as long as I've been singing.
Mm-hmm.
My first public singing experience was as a child. I was 5 years old and very proudly and happily sang the fantastic song made popular by Whitney Houston, The Greatest Love of All.
Right.
And then later in my childhood was and remain an enormous fan both of Whitney Houston, but also of the soprano, also from Southwest Ohio, Kathleen Battle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually in my childhood, but certainly once I got to college, where questions around the relationship between race, blackness in particular, and repertoire for singers started to be a question that I wanted to think about in relation to the written word and discourse, not only in song performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was as an undergraduate that I began formal and very traditional research as a music scholar. And that's continued and will keep going. Then to answer your question about a day job, that line between, you know, vocation, occupation, avocation, I'm not sure. I can say that I spend a vast majority of my energy in the classroom working with students, thinking through the significance of music in the human experience. And this is something that I love.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that professing is my day job.
Okay.
But certainly that's all couched within the work that I do as a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And then as an academic writer as well. So these are interrelated, but I am a music professor. There's no two ways about that.
That sounds like you don't have, sounds like you're pretty busy, actually. And it's not really a fair question, because if you sing, you mostly do it at night. So your night job would be a day job. You know, I guess it gets confusing.
You know, it works out well, actually, and I'm very thankful for that. And the work that I do with artist Wodehouse, with her, it's her chamber music group, Melodeon, actually,
mm-hmm.
that allows for it allows me to really keep a life in the performance world. We do concerts 4 to 5 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the chamber music group specializes in early American music.
Cool.
So,
I'm sorry, do you know her? Do you know the website off the top of your head?
Yes, it's actually the Melodeon website is couched within her website. So it's artistwodehouse.com.
Okay, all one, Artist Wodehouse, is nothing in between. That's
exactly. All together.
Terrific. Marty, it's been really tremendous talking to you. I'm proud of myself. I managed to keep up. and I also have a call, so it would have been even better if I didn't. But I very, very much appreciate you taking time out. And I wish you all the luck with the research and with the performance. And maybe I'll come see you sometime since you're in the city.
That would be great. Thank you for this.
I appreciate it very much. This has been the Daily Music Break. Daily Music Break is at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Please stop by for insights into music across all eras and genres and for free email newsletters. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Get down on your knees and ask the mighty God I serve, have mercy if you please, my good Lord.